Attack of the Final Girls is a podcast about the horror genre, so listener discretion is advised. Please check the show notes for specific content warnings for this episode. And of course, beware of spoilers.
Welcome to Attack of the Final Girls. I'm Juliet.
And I'm Teresa.
And we are here today to talk about a movie that we love, that we almost probably didn't even need to watch because I think both of us have seen it so very many times, but it's still fun to watch again. Demons!
Yay! This is like the quintessential Italian horror film that I feel like everybody either has seen it or has seen a movie that was inspired by this movie.
Absolutely.
Or like has scenes that were inspired by this movie. It was nice though to take this time to like really critically think about it and understand that you don't really have to critically think about it.
Yeah, you can, but you don't have to.
Yeah.
This came out in 1985. It was directed by Lamberto Bava and written by Lamberto Bava, Dario Argento, Dardano Sacchetti, and Franco Farini. It was actually originally supposed to be part of a trilogy. Lamberto Bava was thinking to do a trilogy like his father had, Mario Bava, like the Black Sabbath trilogy, and had gotten the story from Dardano Sacchetti, like the first draft of the story, and thought, no, actually, I think there's something more there. And so started working with the other writers, brought Argento in to produce and to co-write, and started really developing this into its own thing. Demons would then go on to have a sequel and would have been a trilogy, but the two sort of alleged third films then just became other films. And so everyone is still waiting to this day to see, will we ever get a Demons 3? Do we even need a Demons 3? Debatable.
I don't know. I think it would be fun to see what other wacky ideas they come up with. But I also think that unless you had some really strong Italian horror directors, that it wouldn't have the same vibe as Demons and Demons 2. Basically, if you read the like cast and production crew and writer and director, it's like a who's who of Italian horror.
Yes.
Pretty much anybody on that list is going to be a person who also made their own movies or collaborated on other movies that are famous. Like any famous Argento film, there's definitely a lot of it, although he didn't direct this movie in particular, there's so much Argento in this movie.
Yeah.
It's like the quintessential movie. You see parts from Bava, you see parts from Argento. It's like the poster child for Italian horror films.
Yeah, and you see a lot of Romero in it too, which really this group of Italian horror filmmakers that were around from about the late 60s into the mid 80s, although many of them continued on after that, but this was really their prime. They took a lot of influence from Romero and really saw what Romero could do, you know, on a very simple budget as an independent filmmaker, and said, we want to do that and we want to do it better or our way. You know, that's how folks like Fulci got started.
This movie also, it has a lot of Italian talent in the film.
Yes.
Not entirely. It's not like exclusively Italian actors and actresses, but for the most part, our main characters are Italian. You have Urbano Barberini, who plays George, who's kind of our hero, our main hero dude. You have Natasha Hovey, who plays Cheryl, his girl, although he says his girl, but like they've just met. So, I mean, you know, in as much as a film will allow you to pair two people together, these people are. And then you have Carl Zinni, who plays Ken, George's friend, and the love interest of Kathy, played by Paola Cazzo. And also, special mention, Goretta Goretta, who plays Rosemary, one of the sex workers who is, we assume to be a sex worker, and people kind of throw that phrase around.
Yeah.
Although maybe Tony just is a social man.
Yeah.
Who's played by Bobby Rhodes, who also plays a character in Demons 2.
Yes.
And then I also want to shout out Fiore Argento is in this, Dario Argento's eldest daughter. She's in this as Hannah. She's the girl with the really, really curly hair who is scared of the movie at the beginning and looks away from the screen with her boyfriend in the back of the theater. So she's also in this film. you had mentioned Asia Argento is in A Demon's Too, but she's like a baby.
Yeah.
Basically.
Well, she's a pretty young kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. In one of the apartments, there's a family that's eating dinner and she's the daughter.
Okay.
And she's in it for a little while, actually. But yeah, she is definitely a kid in that
so
one.
It's a family affair.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. And then the other thing I wanted to shout out is you have Claudio Simonetti, who is of Goblin fame, but also, you know, did his own like scoring and sound design and things for, well, music design for a lot of other movies. And this is one of them where Claudio Simonetti is kind of scoring this film on his own. But you also have this soundtrack outside of the Claudio Simonetti aspect of it. The soundtrack is like killer.
Oh, yeah.
It is the quintessential 80s soundtrack. You've got Motley Crue. You have Billy Idol. You have Accept and Saxon, too. So this movie has everything, you know. And anytime you hear Motley Crue in a movie, although pretty much all their songs sound exactly the same, it's so fun to like, it like amps you up.
Yeah.
And I feel like the placement, too, of the Motley Crue song in this movie is perfect because it's at, like, the chaotic times, like, when they're all rushing out of the theater and trying to go up the stairs and get out the front doors, you hear, like, the Motley Crue, like, bass line, and it's great. It's just perfect.
It's interesting to consider, like, this movie came out in 85, so MTV was already well underway, obviously starting here in the U.S., but going global very quickly. And I always remember when I was in film school, one of my professors said, you know, MTV changed everything in terms of filmmaking. And you can kind of see that influence in this movie, because alongside these sort of really beautiful shots that are kind of hallmarks of Italian horror cinema, some great nods to Romero, you see some things in this movie very specifically that really nod to music video culture in a really cool way, where you're like, in some of those scenes, like the scene with the motorcycle in the theater toward the end of the movie, you're like, this could be a music video, and it's shot like a music video. You know, I've seen especially like hair metal bands, you know, shoot their videos this way with these types of shots and these angles and things like that. So it's a nice nod to the culture of the time.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. It definitely seems like we could be taking clips from this movie and just like line it up with that Motley Crue song and like, well, call it a day.
Yeah.
You know, like no further work needs to be done. Or you just have like, you know, Nikki Sixx and all of the Motley Crue guys just like shredding on the stage and
yes.
You could just like intersplice that, but it wouldn't. Or they could have like the zombie makeup or the demon makeup and it would be perfect. We're basically doing it already. Motley Crue, give us a call.
Well, yeah.
We can help you out with this, I think.
We've got you. We've got you.
Yeah, but it's always fun to watch an Italian horror film with Claudio Simonetti at the musical helm because the music is just so wild.
Yeah.
Like a film like this could definitely go in a more serious direction, but I feel like when you have Simonetti at the helm, you can't. Like the levity is there and you're just kind of like laughing and having fun the entire time.
Yeah, his score work and really Goblin score work in general brings this rock and roll sensibility to horror. Like they keep it spooky, but they also bring like rock and roll and European influenced rock and roll. So there's some like prog action happening there. There's really good use of keyboards in a way that like the Americans kind of hadn't gotten to yet.
Mm-hmm.
That keeps it like both fun, but a little funky, but also creepy. And I think it also kind of makes these movies timeless. I was thinking as we were watching this that, you know, if this were an American movie made in the 90s, like an American movie made a decade later, I feel like we would be watching it and it would feel really dated. And there's something about these Italian films of the 70s and 80s that although they are so of their era, they feel kind of timeless and out of time. And they don't feel dated at all. They just feel like they've created their own sort of horror world. And I think Simonetti's scoring does a lot to contribute to that.
These movies definitely, although you've got all the 80s hallmarks, you have the crust punks, you have Berlin in the 80s, you know, the party scene sort of in the 80s, the club scene there. You also have like this really killer score. But the film itself feels like it couldn't exist in real life. Like we're watching a fairy tale almost. Yeah. And I think that so much of these sort of films, less so giallo films, because those kind of, although they do feel weird, it's in a different way versus like Suspiria.
Yeah.
Or like other Argento horror films. Those feel like fairy tales.
Yeah.
And this one, agree. This one feels like that too, except darker and a little bit more grounded.
I feel like that's a combination of Argento and Lamberto Bava, especially taking influence from his father, because I feel like so many of Mario Bava's films have that same kind of like out of time, like fairy tale-esque feeling to them, obviously with a big old horror twist.
Yeah.
In a way that like Fulci's films, well, no. Some of Fulci's films tend to feel more grounded in reality. Like Zombie feels very grounded in a very real world where horrible things are happening. Some of Fulci's other films, not so much. He's kind of the one that I think toes the line either way.
And if you haven't seen this movie, it is pretty readily accessible.
Yeah.
It's out on DVD. It's out on Blu-ray. It looks like it's streaming still. I think Shudder might have it.
It usually makes the rounds on the streaming services, but Shudder has had it for quite a while.
And the movie is about this gal and her friend, Cheryl and Kathy, who get invited to this movie screening at Metropole, which is actually still a real place in,
yes,
in Berlin. They get invited to this movie screening, although they have no idea what the movie is about, along with lots of other random people who also show up at this theater. And then they watch this movie, which is really scary. And then things that are happening in the movie start to happen in real life.
Yeah.
There's like artifacts from the movie that exist in the theater. And then, what do we say? Chaos ensues.
Yes.
And there are people that argue that there is no plot to this movie. And I could see that too. If you want to turn off your brain about it and just watch the chaos and the carnage, you know, occur and have it happen to you, totally fine. But if you want to delve a little bit deeper into the story, you absolutely can do that too. And I think it's accessible for both types of people who want to either access something that's a little bit like crunchier in terms of plot, but you can also like turn your brain off and watch this at a party with your friends and be like, oh my God, look, she had a giant zit on her neck and it exploded and it's gross. And yeah, now she's a demon.
Yeah, I think that this movie is so engaging on so many levels. You can kind of choose your own adventure in terms of what you want out of a watching experience. You know, this is like several other horror films, a movie that it and its sequel make it onto our TV, you know, way more times than I can count at my house. And sometimes we're like sitting there watching it and really kind of like picking apart the plot, especially the relationship between the first and second film and like the movie within a movie, within a TV show, within a movie,
right,
kind of a situation. And other times we're just like, it's just on and it's a kick-ass score and it's visually beautiful and it's fun. And we're like, there's Tony being a badass and, you know, this, that, and the other.
It's not like Suspiria, where I would say Suspiria requires a little bit more attention and focus for you to like extract the story and meaning out of that film. This is not like that.
Yeah.
You know, you can come into it and be like, oh no, I just want to like, you know, have a couple beers and watch a movie. And this is totally okay to do that. Also, though, if you're watching it passively like that, and then maybe you like take a time where you're like, okay, well, I want to focus on this movie. There's a lot more that's like kind of underlying the story there. And a lot of questions like, what the hell? Why is it that the usherette is like smiling at the beginning of the film? And like you had mentioned, is she in on it? Because otherwise, who started the film?
Yep.
What about the man in black with the mask? Like, what the hell is his deal? And you can start asking those questions, or you could be like, I don't care.
Yeah.
Shrug.
Yeah.
You know?
Chaos is ensuing.
Yeah, exactly. There are, you know, demons that are happening and they're killing everybody and it's great. Also, why is the blind dude, like, why does he know so many things? Is it because he, like, you know, got some sort of weird sense off the mask at the beginning and then he's, like, saying, no, it's not them, it's the theater that's killing everyone? Why does he know that?
Also, are the people that are in the theater random? Or were they chosen because they represent archetypes?
Right.
You know, you have the older squabbling couple that seems very unhappy in their marriage. You have the young lovers. You have the blind character who's kind of the harbinger. Mm-hmm. You have Tony and his two women who are both like, you know, again, debatable. People like to say that, you know, they are sex workers. but are they, or are they just sexually open and free people there to have a good time, you know, right. sort of representing that? You know, it could be that these folks are all random. It could be that they're intentional, which then begs the question, like, was Kathy being there a sort of, like, was she not necessarily part of the plan?
Right.
Because they keep emphasizing that over and over again. Like, Cheryl gets the extra ticket for her and the guy gives it to her, but she kind of is like, I don't want to be here. I'm scared. I don't know. And we kind of hear that over and over again. It's like, ooh, was she just kind of collateral damage in this? You know, were some of them meant to be there and others were just kind of, you know, whatever. You need bodies.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up because Kathy ends up being like the one that brings the demon through, like through into the real life. As where all of the other people, they either get scratched or bitten and then they get like these nasty zits and they start puking this green like pea soup and then they become demons as well. And that's kind of how it goes for everybody except for Kathy. Kathy never gets scratched. She doesn't get touched. She doesn't get bitten. She just starts feeling weird. And they're like, get up. We gotta leave. Come on, let's go. And then she is like, where am I? In this like weird otherworldly voice. And then she's on all fours. And then this demon like pops up out of her back.
Yeah, like alien style.
Yeah, which is strange because why would she be the one
of
the four that still exist?
Right.
As humans, there's Kathy, Cheryl, George, and Ken at the end. And the four of them are getting ready to leave. And Kathy is the one that, you know, she has the demon pop out of her. The demon then scratches Ken. And then it's just George and Cheryl who have the go ahead to leave. Well, actually, they're like, let's leave. And then they're like, wait, we can't leave. We can't leave Ken like this. And it's like, no.
You actually can.
You have to.
Yeah.
This is not how this works. Like, did you see everybody else in the theater? Because, yeah, you can leave him.
I mean, that is like the folly of every zombie film, too. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole like, oh, surely this person will be the exception to whatever it is. And obviously they never are. Never, ever, ever.
Right.
You know, but that is sort of like a big trope in zombie films. And I do think that this movie takes a lot from zombie mythology, although it is called demons. You know, this is not your tradition. Well, I don't even want to say traditional. This is not what we have come to know as demonic possession films. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like actually The Exorcist was so singular back in the day, and there's been this revival, you know, on and on and on and on. We're seeing them all now still of all of these very Catholic possession films, you know, that deal with like the capital D devil and his capital D demons and exorcisms. This is not that. This is like some kind of possession, but it manifests more like a zombie outbreak, you know, where you see it jump from person to person to person. And you have these characters in an isolated space that are trying to survive.
You know, the like quote unquote definition of a zombie wasn't really hard and fast at this point either. Yeah. And I will say, especially not for Italian filmmakers, because they like do whatever they want. They don't give a shit. So it wasn't like they were like, well, it can only be a thing that bites other people in order to move it along.
Oh, yeah. When you look at the progression of the zombie series, which spun off of Dawn of the Dead, it's like, it is not as linear and straightforward as the Romero Dead series. Like, it spun off. People often act like Land of the Dead was so, like, outlandish and weird and different. And I'm like, if you look at what the Italians were doing with the zombie series, actually Land of the Dead fits right in with that sort of, you know, situation where as zombie progresses in the series, it's not the traditional like ghoul that's going to bite you, chop off the head, etc. Obviously that came a little later, but you know, it is more rooted in the fantastical, I'll say.
Yeah, zombies initially were just meant to be violent.
Right.
It wasn't like must bite, must eat flesh, must, you know, create more zombies. It was more just like they wanted to kill anything that was human.
Yeah.
Like if you go all the way back to like Matheson's I Am Legend and what Romero did initially with his zombies, it was just kill, maim, destroy, not so much bite to create new ones, although that was an incidental, you know, cause of that. It's funny to read other people's analysis of this film too, because I read, it was just a comment We're not going to link it because it was just common. I don't know where it is now. But they mentioned that they think that this movie was a lot more Catholic than other movies that happened during this time, which I don't see that considering, like, I do see how they could explain that in that people who were bad or traditionally, like, were kind of shitty in the film end up being the ones who are first turned into demons. However, outside of that, I see very, very little parallel between this and, like, any sort of traditional Catholicism. So yeah, that's just me. I disagree with it.
Yeah, I don't really see that.
Especially because in so many other films that all of the people who collaborated on this movie have made, there's a lot more overt,
yes,
like, Christian or Catholic,
yes,
messaging. So that's why I don't see it here. I see, like, a darker take on a zombie / demon movie, but I don't see religion being a part of it because there's never anybody who are like, God will save us or we have to pray.
And yeah.
Nobody wearing crucifixes, which is like sort of a hallmark in movies where you have like God being the, you know, the savior or the help or whatever. I don't even see any imagery in this movie that would indicate to me that it's even especially religious.
No, I would say you can read way more Catholicism into some of Argento's other films and some of Bava's other films. But no, this doesn't strike me as particularly Catholic, other than just like the very beginning, the straight up morality of who are the first people to die. But that even goes by the wayside very quickly because no one is safe in this movie.
Right.
You know, even a character like Hannah, who I think you could argue like Hannah is really set up to be like the kind of virginal, sweet, like kind girl. She is not spared and she is not special. And her, you know, innate sweetness does not save her at all. Like, none of these characters are safe, even Cheryl.
Yeah. And none of them are especially good either. Like,
no.
We're not seeing George and Ken kind of go out of their way to save anyone else outside themselves. They're not like, you know, these like shining white knights or anything like that. Although they do like try to be knights in shining armor for Cheryl and Kathy. But outside of that, they're not especially good. Like, of anyone, you could probably argue Tony is the white knight because he comes out and is like, y'all need to shut up. Like, we got to figure this out. And then explains to them, like, this is what's happening. The mask has infected Rosemary. And now those, you know, the things that we're showing in the movie are going to be happening to us now. But let's find a way to get out of here. And although that, you know, Tony ends up getting murdered and hung with one of the other guys, I guess you can't really call him a cheater. Because the blind guy's niece is just, like, fooling around with this dude. But, like, that's his niece. So she's allowed to fool around with whoever she wants, I guess.
She's a grown-ass woman.
Yeah. It does strike me, though, that she wanted to come to the movie specifically to fool around with this guy. And then she had to bring her uncle, like, incidentally.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of unfair for him.
It is interesting that Bobby Rhodes's character in both Demons 1 and Demons 2 is like the one who steps up and is like trying to lead people and trying to really help people survive. And I wonder, because he is in this one of three characters of color, and in the second one, I think one of the only characters of color, if I'm remembering correctly. I wonder if that is, again, because the Italians were so enamored of George Romero and of Night of the Living Dead, specifically a nod to Ben in Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah, I think so. I could definitely see that. Also, what is the snack situation at this theater?
I know, it's weird. It's vending machines, right?
Like, there's no popcorn, there's no candy.
Yeah.
How early would you have to get to this movie?
Ugh, drive me crazy. I have so many opinions about snack situations at movie theaters anyway. Like, our friend Jeff always talks about this with me. We're like, why do you not serve coffee, for the love of God? Even just black coffee. Like,
yeah. And also, like, I pay your exorbitant prices, which we all know are absolute highway robbery.
Yeah.
I pay the exorbitant prices for everything else. Let me bring in my friggin' coffee.
I know.
I will buy your stupid $5 popcorn. I will buy your $7 drink. I don't even have, I'm not a member, movie, whatever the fuck, member. I'm not a member of that. Let me bring in my coffee because I already paid a lot of money for it.
Yeah.
I don't want it to be out in the car and get all gross. just let me bring it in. Yeah. And then maybe I won't fall asleep.
I know. I'm like, I will still buy a giant bottle of water because I'm a millennial and I have to have three drinks, you know, like
using every single cup holder. Yes. The cup holder two seats down.
That's the next iteration in movie theater seats, like multiple cup holders on the same seat.
You should get, they have those that are 3D printed where it fits into one cup holder and then branches out into two cup holders. So you can double fist it on the one side.
I need that.
Really, they should get it so that it spins. So you could like drink one drink and then like spin it and then drink the other drink. Yeah. With your twisty straw.
That would be lovely.
And I also disagree with the fact that they won't let you bring in your water bottle.
Yeah.
Because like you have a drinking fountain.
Yeah.
So like, let me just fill up my water in the drinking fountain.
Well, they want you to buy their $7 Aquafina.
Well, guess what? I'm bringing in my water bottle in my giant bag. Search me. You know, during the pandemic, they were really, really relaxed about.
Yeah.
In the early days of the pandemic, they were super relaxed about that. And it could have also been they were like, you guys rented out the theater. Like, screw it. You know?
Yeah.
And then it was probably about 2 years ago. They were like, ma'am, you can't bring in your coffee. And I was like, I've been bringing in my coffee for 2 years. Leave me alone.
And also, I'm like, fine, but then have coffee to sell me.
Yeah.
That's what I get irritated about.
Yeah, it's not like it's liquor.
Right.
Like, you want to smell it?
Yeah. Like, sell me a black coffee then.
That's truly the place where they mess up. Because knowing coffee drinkers, you're going to pay the $5 for black coffee that costs 50 cents to brew.
Oh, yeah.
For the whole pot.
I would. Consistently. Anytime.
Tons of people would.
Yeah.
Like, very, very common. And it's not like it's any harder than making a whole ass pizza.
Right.
They make ridiculous stuff at the movies now.
They do.
It used to be like candy, popcorn, sometimes hot dogs, you know, like easy stuff that you could just easily make. And now it's like, do you want a whole ass spaghetti dinner? Not only do you want that, do you want me to bring it to your seat?
They had samosas for a hot minute. And I was just like, what is going on here?
But yeah, I did wonder, like, Kathy gets a single Coke out of the machine. Yes. And I'm like, that's it? That's all Coke. You're going to get? They don't even know what this movie is. There aren't any posters when they go in. It doesn't like have anything on the marquee that says, I don't even think there is a marquee that says what the movie is. And they just go in raw dogging this movie with a Coke.
Yeah.
I'm like, couldn't be me. I'll tell you what. I got to come prepared with some buffer snacks, food, drinks. I'm spoiled. I'm movie theater spoiled, I think. I'm like, should I get nachos and a pretzel or just nachos? There's always like decision paralysis when I get up there too.
I'm like,
I'm going to get the pretzel bites. No, I'm going to get the nachos. And then I just end up getting a drink. And my partner will be like, why didn't you get nachos? You said you wanted them. And I was like, I couldn't decide. And then I just got a drink because I couldn't say it fast enough. And then he told me my total. And I was like, well, yep. That's all I wanted. Yep.
Yeah. Like, that's fine. I don't want to inconvenience you.
You person working at the concession stand. And we're friendly with most of those people too. So I'm sure it wouldn't be like weird for them to be like, oh yeah, I can add that on. Nope, will not. Would throw myself out a window before I would be like, also, may I please? No.
Nope. Definitely not.
Struggles of millennials in the movie theater.
Yes.
Like, basically just, we want to bring in all of our own drinks, but we won't because rules. And then also, we will never ask you for more than what you offer.
No.
I still haven't figured out how to do the deliver to your seat thing. And I'm always like, man, I should get it delivered to the seat. And then I'm like, no, that seems like effort.
I'm worried that would disturb the people around me. So I would never do it.
Exactly. Because like, what if the previews are already on and everybody's like wants to watch the previews?
Yeah.
As long as it's not Mission Impossible 16 times again. So yeah, I feel you there. If they came in like 3 minutes into the movie, I'd be like, what the hell?
Yeah,
like,
why are you?
And then I would just like take it super fast and just be like, get out of here.
And it comes in a bag, and then I would worry about making noise at the bag, and
that happens so often too. Like, struggles of movie theater.
Yeah,
we really got spoiled.
Yeah, we did.
There was I think the last what was the last movie we saw?
Imaginary.
There was somebody whose phone went off, and I like immediately like. My head was in flames. Like,
yeah.
What? Can you just not? Can you just remember how to go to a movie, please?
Yeah.
Speaking of Coca-Cola, There's so many Coca-Cola cans that are like very, very prominent in this movie.
Yeah.
And it just makes me feel like Americans love Coca-Cola. Thumbs up. Like, let's show as much Coca-Cola as we can.
That and checks
I'm pretty sure if you make a movie in Italy like that, at least during the 80s, you probably didn't have to pay like a bunch of fees in order to show the.
I doubt it. Yeah, I don't.
So they just slid under the radar.
Yeah, probably.
As where now it'd be like, okay, that'll be $50 million for showing a real Coke can.
Yeah.
Let's get all of your profits from distributing. I don't know if that's still a thing, but I remember like in the late 90s and early 2000s, there was this whole rash of movies where they only used what was clearly like MacBooks and Mac products, like laptops and stuff, but they always had to cover up the Apple because they didn't want to have to pay the money.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's still a thing, but...
I don't know. I mean, then there's the reverse of that where there's actual like endorsement deals and product placement where it's really obvious. And obviously, you know, like Wayne's World spoofs this where you have like the product placement in the movie where somebody is very obviously like holding a can of Coke or a can of Pepsi or something like that, you know, or you see that brand over and over again in a movie. And I can kind of clock those now in modern movies where I'm like, oh, that's obviously a product placement because of the way it is in the shot or the way the product is being used.
Most of the time they just will like use generic, you know, now if it doesn't have anything to do with the movie, then they just use like beer, brand beer or like Coke. Well, yeah. I don't even think you can use Coke, but like cola.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought it was funny. And like, it's also funny the parallel between Kathy like actually drinking a Coke. Also, where'd she get a straw?
Yeah, good point. That vending machine did not seem to have straws.
No. And the punks in the car doing Coke out of a can by snorting it via the straw.
Yes.
Like, most pain in the ass way to do Coke ever.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot of room to have to snort something. It's already hard to snort it out of a dollar bill or 20 or whatever you're doing. It's already hard to do it that way. It would be even harder to do it like out of a whole ass straw. I think. It's kind of goofy.
It is.
But it's funny.
Their whole drug ritual is confusing to me.
Yeah. The one dude is like driving and he seems like he's really coked up, but he's not acting like it. And then the other three goofballs in the car are just being like total idiots about it. It's fun. It's always fun to see punks in Italian horror films and just really 80s films in general. Like Return of the Living Dead is coming to mind too. It's just funny because you know that they're kind of cannon fodder and they're definitely going to die.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I like all of them do in Return of the Living Dead, too.
Yep.
There was a lot of dialogue, too, that I thought was like pretty similar between those two films, between the punks in this movie and Return of the Living Dead.
Yeah, definitely.
It was fun. Yeah. I like that one a lot. And, of course, they're like totally oblivious to what's going on. They're just like, wow, there's loud noises in there. We should figure out what's happening. Let's break in.
Yeah. Which is, you know, kind of like Return of the Living Dead, where they're just like, let's just go, like, get naked in a graveyard and whoops, acid rain. Uh-oh.
Yeah. Yeah. And they also are the ones that let the infection out into the world. You know, the blind man comes out and then he texts the two police officers and then the three of them take the sickness into the world. So it's kind of funny. They have to be there. They're kind of a plot device to make sure that the sickness gets everywhere else because otherwise it would just stay in the in the theater. So they're definitely not in on the plan. I wonder if it was always meant to just stay in the theater and just kind of like fizzle out in there. It was just an experiment or like a nasty, evil thing to do just in there. And then they kind of like made it go bigger. I wonder.
Well, so that brings up a bunch of theories about the connection between the first one and the second one. And without getting too far into the second one, you could argue that in the first one, it was meant to be an experiment to stay in the theater to see if it would work so that they could then broadcast it on television in the second one and, you know, bring the infection out further. But that raises the question. So is it the cut from the mask that triggers the infection? Is it the movie? Is it the combination? Is it like the blood plus, and I'm reading silver nitrate right now, so like this is in my head. Is it like the blood plus whatever is happening, whether it's on the screen or baked into the film, you know, whether it's some kind of subliminal messaging or imagery or something like that, that brings the demon forth? Is it just the movie? Is it just the mask? I don't know. I love like theorizing about that.
Silver nitrate is really good.
It is so good. I like that. I'm like halfway through. Yeah.
What's the author's name? Sylvia Garcia Moreno?
Yes.
I love them.
Yeah.
Such a good author.
Yeah.
Especially Silver Nitrate, because it was like relevant to my interests.
Yes.
But it was really, really good. I like flew through that one. Some specific stuff about Italian movies that I wanted to touch on. Italian directors love to have a damsel in distress.
Yeah.
Like the thing. Like, just watch the first 5 minutes of this movie. Watch the first 5 minutes of Suspiria. Watch the first 5 minutes of New York Ripper. Like, tell me that Italians don't love a damsel in distress. Like, a pure woman who is being pursued. And although we find out later in this movie, like, late in the movie, you think, okay, yeah, it was specific to her, but like we find out within the first 5 minutes that wasn't malicious necessarily,
right?
Until later. But like Suspiria, you know, they just love to have a damsel in distress in so many Italian horror films. So this is no, it doesn't break away from the streak of those.
Yeah.
It's really common. And I think that that's sort of what leads it to be a fairy tale as well, is that feeling of, okay, we have this woman that we're following. She is unintentionally, or, you know, she doesn't know that she's being led into this malicious situation. And then she has to use her smarts and also the help of like a big hunky guy to help her get through this. At least in some of the films, obviously, like Suspiria is not that way. But
yeah.
Although you could boil down a lot of 80s horror movies to being that damsel in distress thing, I think Italian horror directors love to use that as the impetus for their movies.
Yeah. Definitely.
They also love a good stabbing scene.
Oh, yeah.
There's a scene in the movie where this, like, damsel in distress is being stabbed through a tent, like, a lot. She's getting all sorts of cut up through this tent. And then later in this film, George takes a sword to all of the zombies that are still living in the theater and cuts them all up. And there's, like, the shot that's like sort of synonymous with horror movies made in the 80s, where it's like the light is glinting off of the knife and there's like lots of stabbing happening and like ineffectual stabbing. Like somebody who stabs into a tent, like you can carve that shit up like super easy. But no, instead he's like stabbing and stabbing and stabbing holes through that so he can poke this woman. And he does stab her fatally eventually, but like he wants to cut her up.
Oh, yeah.
Like New York Ripper does the same thing. They just love a good stabbing.
Yeah.
They love to have a woman in distress and getting all stabbed up.
Yep.
And the voiceover. We can't talk about an Italian horror film without talking about the dubbing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And although it's necessary for them because they want to make sure they have really good sound and really good, like when they're going back doing ADR, they want it to be really crisp and not have like the gross, like, you know, atmospheric sounds that you might have otherwise. And I think it also makes it a little bit easier because you don't have to be so focused on like the boom and also lav mics if you're using those and making sure like you're not rubbing up your clothes against it. So they just basically ADR the whole thing.
Yeah.
It also makes it kind of feel comical when you have a movie where like not all the dialogue matches up with their mouths and you know that it's going to be, you know, a voiceover the entire time. It kind of also makes it funnier, I think.
Yeah. It also, you know, really made it easier for these European filmmakers to easily make their movies accessible to an American audience, because that was who they were really going for. They knew that the horror market was in the United States, and that's where you could really make the biggest impact. So by dubbing their films, dubbing all of their dialogues, they could easily make a good version for the US market without having to either, you know, they could get the actors that had the look that they wanted, but also dub them over to get that good sounding dialogue that an American audience at that time would have really been demanding.
Yeah. And you'll see that in so many Italian horror films. Like, it's almost a requirement. Like, you're not going to see an Italian horror film that doesn't have dubbing over it.
I mean, the Spanish ones of there are the same way.
Right. It's kind of campy and goofy, but it's also, like, lots of fun. And it's also, like, thank you.
Yeah.
Because there are lots of movies that are made where the syncing isn't very good, or they redo the entire movie in another language.
Yes.
And then it's like, it's difficult, you know, to understand. So it's nice. It's a nice thing. And it happens all the time.
Well, and I think if you think about it, I don't think we would have these films immediately rising to the level that they have and continue to do if they had been subtitled, which is unfortunate because there are so many good films that are, you know, in the language of the people that made them that are excellent and are subtitled and are worth our time. But I think not all audience members can, for a variety of reasons, you know, do the subtitle thing. And so I don't know that if this had been subtitled rather than dubbed, that it would have ended up as popular as it currently is. Like, it might be the type of thing that stayed very niche and was just now starting to get, you know, elevated to the level that we see it at, you know, that we have seen it at for years now.
Yeah, I agree. So I wanted to also mention the special effects in this film, because if you love a good 80s film with practical effects, like, please watch this movie because it's great. Sergio Stivaletti is one of four people who were involved in the special effects on this movie. There's a zit that pops on Rosemary's face and it's friggin' disgusting. There's all sorts of zits that are being popped all over the place. The teeth and fingernail effects, especially on, I can't remember her name, but Rosemary's other female companion, like, her fingernails crack and there's blood coming out of them, and then claws, and it's just gross. Her teeth fall out, and then she gets like these little Nosferatu, like, baby rabbit fangs. That's what I call them, is baby rabbit fangs. And Sergio Stivaletti actually worked on opera as well, and he also worked on Cemetery Man, which is another seminal kind of underground Italian horror film. So they're great. They're like campion parts. It looks like either there were some influences from The Evil Dead, or it could have just been parallel development, but you definitely see pieces of this movie in Evil Dead 2.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, you definitely do. And you definitely see a lot of effects that, whether they were parallel to Evil Dead 1 or were iterating off of Evil Dead 1, you see these effects, these scenes, these kind of hallmark gore scenes emulated in movies up until present day. I think actually Evil Dead Rise, some of the effects in that specifically nod to this film. Some of the hand things and things like that, I feel like are like specific, like almost like the shots are parallel. And I feel like it's a real hat tip to the effects in this movie.
Yeah, I agree. Considering this movie was sort of made on a shoestring budget and there was a lot of like behind the scenes sort of squabbling about the writing and the script and who's funding what and that kind of stuff, I wonder how they got a whole ass helicopter for the scene where the helicopter falls through the roof and then George just magically knows how to use the winch and the grappling hook gun to get them out onto the roof. Like, I don't know. Yeah. If it were me, I'd be like, oh, cool, now we have a whole ass helicopter down here. Cool, now we're going to die with a helicopter down here.
Yeah, exactly.
George is like, no, let me just like repel myself and like
George is a secret action hero.
Yeah, apparently he's like Arnold Schwarzenegger. And there's also, that's another I think hat tip in Evil Dead 2, there's a scene, a very iconic scene in this movie, where George is posing on top of the helicopter with the grappling hook gun, and he looks just like Ash with his shotgun and with his chainsaw hand. Just another way that this movie is echoed in other films. But I was like, what the hell? Where did they get the whole ass helicopter? And it's a real helicopter. Like, you can't fake the funk with a whole ass helicopter.
Right. Yeah.
It's not a model or anything like that, because he's standing on it. Yeah. There are people inside of it. Bonkers. It was just sitting in a set somewhere and they're like, yeah, let's use that.
Exactly.
And I do love this last sequence of the film, because it just like ratchets up in ridiculousness. From the time that Kathy gets a demon pops out of her back and then Ken gets scratched by the demon, then they go up the stairs and Ken's like, please, please stab me with the sword. It's like, friends don't let friends live as demons, obviously. But he says, like, this is my last favor to ask of you. Like, please stab me with the sword. We don't see it exactly, but it looks like George probably decapitates him with the sword.
That would be my assumption, yeah.
And then George is like, hey, let's just get on this motorcycle and then just, like, cut everybody in the theater up.
Yeah.
And then they're getting ready to get eaten by all these zombies because they've fallen off the motorcycle and they're like still cutting people, but they're about to get overwhelmed. And then a whole ass helicopter falls out of the ceiling and they're like, oh, okay, cool. And so Cheryl's like, do something, do something. So George is like trying to start the helicopter because he also knows how to do that.
Right. I would not know.
There's too many. There's way too many switches.
Yeah.
No, decision paralysis. You'd be like, what? Which one?
Yeah.
And then he dead alives everybody and just chops all of them up with the helicopter blades. What?
Yeah.
There's no way. And he's like actually doing the thing to get the helicopter to start. I'm like, oh, I'm pretty sure it's not that simple.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Maybe George took some flying lessons.
Maybe.
That we don't know about. Yeah. And also like rappelling EMT grappling hook gun lessons.
Sword skills.
Sword skills. He learned how to ride a motorcycle.
Yeah.
All of these things. He's like, I'm not sure why I'm drawn to all these activities. And then he's like, cool.
It all paid off.
A demon outbreak in a theater where I'm trapped. I've trained for this.
Yeah, I'm ready.
He also stabs a bunch of people. Tony drops his stiletto knife at one point when he dies. And then George like starts stabbing all sorts of people with his stiletto. And it's like, damn, all right, George, what the hell?
Whatever works for you.
Because he totally looks like a goofball at the beginning of the movie. But then the end, you're like, oh, he's kind of a badass.
Yeah.
And this is one of very few movies. I couldn't think of any off the top of my head, but also my brain's not working. So maybe that's why. But this is one of very few movies where there's a final dude.
Yeah, that is true.
We don't get a final girl. We get a final guy in this movie.
Yep.
Although the movie totally psychs us out where we're like, oh, George and Cheryl both survive.
Yep.
And then they get into a Jeep with a bunch of like disaster preppers, which this is why it's good to know where your local disaster prepper is, because they probably have a Jeep somewhere that is ready with 1,000 guns in it to get out of Dodge, provided that there's a demon outbreak. And they're like, oh, yeah, we're getting out of town. And then all of a sudden, Cheryl's like, I'm a demon now. And then the little boy's like, nope. And like shotguns are off the back of the Jeep.
The little boy has also been training for this.
Yes. Yeah. It's funny because he's just like eating a hunk of bread.
Yeah.
And they're just like very nonchalant about the whole thing. Like, oh, we're just going to go to the country because like obviously shit's going down here. You want some bread? Also, there's guns in the floor.
Yeah.
And then we get George as our final guy. I just thought that was really interesting because most of the time it's like either everybody dies.
Right.
Or you get like the final girl or the final couple or what have you, you know, who gets spirited away to whatever eventuality. But this time, nope.
Final dude.
Yeah. And it could have easily gone either way. We could have easily had George become like the zombie after doing all this shit and helping Cheryl get out, because Cheryl definitely would have gotten eaten immediately if it hadn't been for George. We get all of this like, you know, him being a Billy Badass throughout the whole thing. And it totally could have easily been him, since he was in more contact, I would say, with the ghouls or the demons. But instead, it's like, nope, it's Cheryl somehow. And we didn't see her get scratched or like eaten or anything. And she turns into one.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird.
It is.
But cool. I mean, it's a cool way to flip it on its head, especially like during the final credits.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so next time, because I'm down for a challenge, you know, I like to challenge myself and watch movies that I don't like and then maybe like get another perspective. So we were talking about Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but spoiler alert, I've never seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. So we're going to cover that one, and I will make sure to fit in all of the things I don't like about the first one.
And I actually love Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 for some very specific reasons that we can get into next time. I have like big time affection for this one, even though I actually didn't like it the first time I saw it, but I think it's because it was a little too close to home. But I have grown very affectionate of that one. So this will be good. It'll be a first time watch for Teresa, and one that I've seen quite a few times at this point.
Always love that. Always love to watch a movie with somebody who's seen it a bunch of times so that I can get kind of like more context and more info, and then also kind of like feed off of what you like about it too. Because I don't like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, so it kind of turned me off of everything except for the new one, because everybody was like, it's dog shit.
Yeah.
The one on Netflix.
Yeah.
But I watched that one anyways, kind of like out of spite, because don't tell me what I can and can't watch.
It's true. It's true.
Like, let me make my own mistakes, okay? Yeah. But yeah, I have wanted to see this one for a long time. I really like Bill Moseley. Like, he is such an icon for, like, horror viewers now, especially, like, the renaissance of, you know, early 2000s horror. And like, he's been huge participant of horror conventions and like getting people to come out to those. So I'm excited to see it.
Yeah. There's an iconic scene with an Oingo Boingo song that's already going around in my head. So I'm ready.
Love Oingo Boingo in yes. horror movies. So. Thanks for listening to Attack of the Final Girls. Find us online at attackofthefinalgirls.com.
And hear bonus episodes at patreon.com/attackofthefinalgirls. We are Attack of the Final Girls on Instagram and TikTok.
Our theme music is by House Ghost and is available on Rad Girlfriend Records.
Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcasting app so you don't miss an episode, and rate and review on Apple Podcasts so more people can find the show. I'm Juliet.
And I'm Teresa. Until next time, stay scary.